I found personally extremely, extremely wounding. I think there were 5 stations on air, of which 1 was expected to survive. You couldn't possibly go back to regulating radio in the way that radio was regulated.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moments series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Tony Stoller.
Well, I grew up in Jewish Northwest London, in a Jewish but non-observant family, only child of quite elderly parents, because Jewish people didn't have children during the war for obvious reasons. I went to the local grammar school, Hendon County, also attended by Peter Mandelson, Lionel Blue, and somebody called Miles Spector, who won't be of interest to you, but played centre forward for Hendon in the Amateur Cup final in 1960 and was therefore very important to me at the time. From there, because the school had links with Cambridge College, I and a few others rather unexpectedly found ourselves in Cambridge. I went up to become a lawyer, spent a week there and realised I did not want to be a lawyer or yet another family solicitor in that part of London. And I did 2 years of history, I did a year of public and international law. I then had no idea what to do and stayed on to do a postgrad degree. I was a radio child, we didn't have a television. I think we probably would have got a television for Princess Margaret's wedding, was that 58? Certainly, I grew up with radio, not television. My father was a great radio listener, Home Service and Third Programme, and Light Programme as well, though that wasn't always admitted to. I mean, he had left school certainly by 12, probably earlier, but very musical, very, very intelligent man. And radio made really all the difference to him, I suspect.
While the Light Programme might well play the waltzes from Der Rosenkavalier and the Home Service do a live broadcast of an act from Covent Garden, the Third Programme would devote an evening to the whole opera.
Quite early, I suspect at about 11 or 12, I was given one of the early transistor radios. I can see it now in an oblong red Bakelite case. And this went everywhere with me. And so I listened mostly to the Light Programme in those days, mostly to speech and comedy. So there was an evening when there was Round the Horn, I think, and the Navy Lark, I think, but I would switch off Semprini's Serenade. I had some taste even then, but always the radio.
Hello. Old ones, new ones, loved ones, neglected ones.
And then fairly soon after that, I acquired an old radio somebody was throwing out, which was a valve set, which enabled me to listen to some other stations. And I started building radio sets. In the age of the transistor radio, I started building valve radio sets and crystal sets and going down to the Edgware Road to buy the components to wind your own coil to make a radio set. Loved it.
This is the BBC Light Programme.
Andy and I decided we were getting married, so I needed a job, and I hawked myself around the milk round. Among the reactions were ICI, who offered me a job providing I'd shaved off my beard, Gillette, who in the same post offered me a job with no such provision. But in the end, I narrowed it down to either Odham's Press, who were publishing the New Sun, or Thompson Regional Newspapers. And because Thompson Regional Newspapers offered me £50 a year more, which was important in those days, I joined them and therefore did not get made redundant when Murdoch took over the Sun a year or so later. Thompson's was very full of itself in those days. It was following the Canadian principles that Roy Thompson had made his belated fortune out of, especially classified advertising and home delivery of newspapers, cutting out newsagents. I joined as a graduate trainee on the commercial side, so I found myself working on the Watford Evening Echo and Luton Evening Post, then went to Reading to work on the Reading Evening Post, and learning how to be a classified ad salesman, learning how to look after newspaper circulation, little bit of editorial, but you were kept well away from the editorial. I then, as graduate trainees do, thought I could do more than they were letting me do, and joined the Liverpool Daily Post and Echo as their marketing manager. Had a great time there. We were at the point of thinking, actually 3.5 years in Liverpool on Merseyside is probably enough, much as we loved it there and still go back. And then there was an advert in the Times for somebody to go and work for the new Independent Broadcasting Authority, which had just taken over radio and wanted a senior officer of radio. I had no idea what they wanted this person to do. I'm invited for interview. I come down on a Saturday morning. I meet a very casually dressed John Thompson, who is at his very characteristic, quirky best. Hugely intelligent, genuinely empathetic, very quirky. He had developed a style which existed in those days in a fog of cigarette smoke. I'm let in through a side door at the IBA in Brompton Road, because the main entrance isn't there. And we have one of those wonderful John Thompson conversations, which is oblique from all possible angles. I didn't know you could have so many oblique angles. It involved John asking me a question nobody has ever asked me before or since. Do you happen to know anyone I might know? He opened up for me awareness of an intellectual life, intellectual world, that I'd always sort of thought was there but had never had any point of contact with. Best person I've ever worked for, without question. He knew people I had only ever heard on the radio. He was a director of radio, pretty much out on his own.
This is ATV, which provides your programmes on the Midlands transmitters of the Independent Television Authority.
The original Independent Television Authority didn't want radio. It's on record. So when it became the Independent Broadcasting Authority, it acquired John Thompson, who had been the special advisor to Chris Chataway at the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications, and segued across in his usual elegant fashion to be director of radio. And pretty much the new IBA left him to it. He and Brian Young clearly got on very well. So he designed, conceived, negotiated, cajoled, persuaded, led independent radio into existence. He conceived it as something which would be not commercial radio in the wider world sense. It would follow the ITV model. That is what he worked on with Chris Chataway when he was in government. That is what he delivered at the IBA, and that is why it took the form it did. And I was invited to come and join as senior officer radio. Within, I think, a fortnight, my managing director in Liverpool was showing me a press cutting from the Times saying Labour government says it will abolish independent radio. I mean, I suspect the IBA wanted me because I knew something about commercial local newspapers, and they were trying to implement a version of commercial local radio. I had a wonderful time. I ended up doing all the odd jobs. I was the person who dealt with the engineers, so I found myself coming down to this part of Hampshire. I enjoy going to Crawley Court, not only because they had chips and custard on the lunch menu, but that was quite an incentive. And that also was a new world for me, interesting, intellectual people delivering a practical technological solution, but mostly much more interested in the theory than the practice, especially things like frequency planning.
You're listening to an engineering test transmission being made by the Independent Broadcasting Authority.
We're transmitting on 557 kilohertz, that's 539 metres, and also 719 kilohertz, that's 417 metres in the medium wave band. And also now on...
I think there were five stations on air, of which one, Radio Clyde, was expected to survive. It was bleak. Everything had really turned against the introduction of a new medium. The long post-war economic boom had ended in a rude shock of the oil crisis with the Arab-Israeli war. The model of independent radio took a very long time to become understood and established.
This is Ken Guy with LBC News. The Middle East War. A meeting of the United Nations Security Council has been called in a bid
LBC
to stop the
was
fighting.
Failing, but couldn't be allowed to fail because it was also providing IRN, the Independent Radio News Network Service, for all the stations. There was also great uncertainty what the political future would hold. I joined between the two 74 elections, so between the two Wilson winning elections, and there was every prospect that the new Labour government would put an end to independent radio.
It is well known that the Labour Party have opposed the introduction of commercial broadcasting, but that in no way prevents me from offering my best wishes to the Independent Broadcasting News Service.
And so one of the main preoccupations of everybody, led by John Thompson in his brilliant behind-the-scenes way, and Jimmy Gordon much more up front, pointing out to the politicians that actually these stations were getting audiences, and the sort of audiences they were getting were the sort of people who were most likely to be voting Labour. It was, of course, much subtler than that and much more multifaceted than that, but I think that's what swung it. I think Howard Wilson, as a supreme pragmatist, thought, why should I upset people I need to vote for me? And therefore it was agreed that the system could expand to 19 stations and that it would freeze at 19. The BBC was then given permission to expand its range of local stations in England to 20. And the Allen Committee was set up to examine the future of broadcasting. And one of the things it was there to report on is what should happen to local radio. I found myself detailed to be attached to the Annan Committee to provide them with the IBA's viewpoint, which was also fascinating.
Well, as Lord Annan was saying, Tom Jackson, leader of the Post Office Workers' Union, was one of the committee members who disagreed with the recommendation on the hiving off of local radio. Mr. Jackson's worried about whether...
So I worked with them as well and turned my vague political interest into a little bit of actual political action and knowledge from the inside, which was also absorbing. When the system was given the limited green light to expand, I worked very much on that, sorting out where the new stations would be, or rather implementing what John Thompson had decided and then negotiating it through the Home Office. And I found all of these people the sort of people I enjoyed dealing with. I don't suppose I'd ever thought I would be a regulator, but having done it and having been given this sort of scope really to do the things I fancied doing, I realised that I was absolutely cut out for it. My university education was right for it. How on earth do you use a combination of history and bits of law? Well, you become a regulator. And it suited my style, it suited my social preoccupations, the things that concerned me about how society should be organised, concerned and still concern. So it was a lovely job. After probably 2.5, maybe 3 years doing that bits and pieces job, I simply became the head of radio programming, and that gave me a whole new range of things to do, which again, I hugely enjoyed. I was involved in making decisions which affected the output. So I would get a phone call from Tim Blackmore saying, I've got John Cooper Clarke coming on, is he allowed to say rude words? Answer, well, what time? Will you put out some sort of warning? Well, yeah, why not? I enjoyed that. Didn't quite as much enjoy patrolling the bureaucracy that I had inherited. It was quite structured, but that fitted the mood of the IBA, which itself was very structured by that stage. But yes, I was involved with decisions, and I was involved with advocating the system. I remember a long interview with the Times educational correspondent about, well, does commercial radio do any education? Of course, this was absolutely the sort of thing that we worked up in order to demonstrate how noble and worthwhile and socially useful the system was. And it did feel as though this was a system of radio which was genuinely contributing to society, to the nation, because the audiences were huge, it was gradually becoming more viable, it was making real inroads into innovation in radio. It was providing a genuine alternative to the BBC on things like parliamentary broadcasting, and it felt really worthwhile. There is this debate about whether regulation held back the medium or promoted the medium. There were nonsenses from time to time, absolutely. We enforced a rule which said that opinion polls could not be broadcast on the day before a parliamentary election. Why? As of now, I have no idea. As at the time, I'm absolutely clear this was the spirit of the time. Regulators do what the statute requires them, but in the context of the society in which they are working. And so, of course, there were nonsenses. On the other hand, the commercial side of business is known to perpetrate the odd nonsense as well. And I believed then, I still believe, that the restrictions which the IBA put on the development of radio caused it to be more imaginative, more creative, and more socially useful than would ever have been the case if it was simply untrammelled commercial radio. Although the climate of the times is completely different, I think there is evidence for that nowadays. But it's a different world. You couldn't possibly go back to regulating radio in the way that radio was regulated. So I'm unashamed about it, but I will hold my hands up to the odd bit of bureaucratic nonsense, maybe more than the odd bit of bureaucratic nonsense. Most learn to play the regulator, which after all is all you really need to do. A few refused to play the regulator, and that led to problems. I didn't sense much resistance to the regime. I was at the point where I'd spent 5 years or so at the IBA, which was beginning to feel like long enough. I would have loved to go out into the radio industry, but didn't really have either the opportunity or the clearance to do so. There had been a huge row when Christopher Lucas had left the early IBA to go and be the managing director of Radio 4th in Edinburgh. But the secretary of the Traders of the Radio Trade Association, the AIRC, Cecilia Garnett, was leaving. I was asked by a couple of the radio companies whether I'd be interested in doing it. And I thought about it and said I would.
What anybody looking at radio after its first year must be impressed with is the distinctiveness of the individual stations. They've all got their own problems. Clyde perhaps had fewer problems than other stations because there was a gap there waiting to be filled.
And I moved across to be the director of the AIRC, the Association of Independent Radio Contractors, which was a horrible job. I didn't do it well. And I didn't feel comfortable in it at any stage, I suspect. The trade body in those days was there primarily to manage labour relations, because there were national union agreements, which were very onerous. Again, absolutely in line with the mood of the times. To manage copyright arrangements with the copyright bodies and to challenge the copyright bodies, to try and manage relations with the advertising industry and the advertisers, and bits of contact with other bodies, including the IBA. It was very difficult working for 19 masters, who were pretty reasonable to me. I can't claim of any maltreatment, but it was an industry with a lot of internal politics. I wasn't very well equipped to deal with it. It's not something I had managed very well before. There were things to do with the running of what was a separate business, which I'd never come across before. Is there enough money to pay the payroll this month? Not something that ever occurred to me or ever thought about. And I really wasn't very comfortable, and I don't think I served the radio industry very well, to be honest. And 14 months in, I got a phone call from Chris Yates, who in those days was the managing director of Radio 210 in Reading. And he said, I'm leaving. He was going to run Radio West. Would you like to come and run 210? Well, thanks, Chris. By the time he'd phoned me at home that evening, Andy, my wife, and I had talked about it and decided, actually, there was nothing we wanted to do better than A, to get out of London, and B, to go and run a little radio station. And it was a good call. I loved doing it. 210, Thames Valley Radio. I knew 210 quite well from the beginning because I'd been the IBA person sent out 3 or 4 weeks before they were due to go on air to tell them they couldn't because the engineers weren't satisfied with the engineering tests. I had to confront Bert Hardy, who was one of Rupert Murdoch's lieutenants, who was courteous but was not a man easily said no to. So I knew what it was going to look like. I knew physically what it was like, had an idea what the output was. It was really ambitious. And I found an excellent group of people who knew what they were doing, who were running a very little, very competent and just about profitable radio station with a decent audience for being on the edge of London, lots of local loyalty, lots of local involvement, very supportive board, including remarkably Sir John Colville, Jock Colville, who had been Churchill's private secretary, who was a remarkable man, and the Marquess of Douro, and now I think the Duke of Wellington, who was the deputy chair. I mean, this was a tiny radio station with the most immensely overweight contacts. It was great fun. I loved it. It was a super job. I did a little bit of broadcasting and the things that nobody else wanted to do or we couldn't afford to pay for. I tinkered a bit with the programmes, but not too much. I tinkered a bit with the advertising and commercial side, but not too much. We ran it as what I think the Americans call a mom-and-pop radio station, which is exactly what it was.
Good evening and welcome to 210's Arts Magazine Spotlight. Presented this evening by Bob Morrison.
The radio station was housed in what had been the Civil Defence Headquarters for Berkshire. Presumably in the event of a nuclear war, this odd building on the very edge of Reading would have been the nerve centre. We discovered later on that the links, the phone links to the various secret premises, went through the telephone exchange in Reading. So presumably that was in some way going to avoid the effect of a nuclear blast, but it didn't affect us at the radio station in those days. And built on to the house, which had become the headquarters, were slightly ramshackle studios, though obviously done to a very high technical standard because of the IBA's requirements. I suppose it felt a bit like going into a slightly run-down, out-of-town hotel. There was a long glass-covered corridor between the old house, which housed the commercial activities, the advertising sales guys, and commercial production, and then linked that to the building in which the studios were. And it did feel a bit like walking from a hotel into its annex because you hadn't quite got the best room. Nice garden, and in the garden we used to run parties, which were great fun. Partying was very much part of those memories from commercial radio. And there was a real, genuine family feel to the whole activity. And I think it provided a good local service. It's interesting to look back now on the sort of responses that people will still give when you say, oh, I was at Radio 210. And they're unfailingly warm, which is encouraging. It was in the nature of the ILR stations, independent local radio stations, in those days. They built an appropriate relationship with their communities, or they did not succeed.
Music and news, 19 hours a day. The time, 9 o'clock.
210.
The challenges were chiefly, where do you take the company now? We were doing probably as well as we were likely to do commercially with the 200,000, 220,000 person total survey area that we served. We had big hitters around that table who were not used to running small corner shop type businesses. How do you take it forward? So we looked at the possibility of linking up with other stations, which the IBA, I was talking earlier about the restrictions, the IBA effectively forbade. We looked at the possibility of launching other initiatives. None of them seemed very convincing. The board meetings were usually convivial affairs because it was going pretty well and the board didn't want to intervene too much. We could report usually that this was reasonably profitable and there had been no particular disasters, and there was every prospect we might pay a dividend to our shareholders one day, though not, of course, just yet.
Now the area forecast.
210.
Tonight will be dry with long, clear periods.
By the mid-80s, from my own point of view, I'm running out of road on radio because I've been a regulator. I've done the trade association, I've run the radio station. There's not really very much more I want to do, and I'm beginning to think perhaps I ought to go and get a proper job, although very reluctantly. So by the end of 84, I have told Radio 210, Thames Valley Broadcasting PLC, that I'm going to leave, and they are busy installing Tony Grundy as my successor. He was my sales director. And so I have become just a little semi-detached by this stage. And I'm aware of a little bit of a mood growing, though still at this stage not a substantial one, that the regulation is no longer serving the radio industry well. But it arises not very much over content regulation. Indeed, I don't remember any challenges to content regulation. I chaired the AIRC programme committee, and we looked at all sorts of things, but I can't recall us ever looking at challenging the fact or the nature of content regulation. The concern was triggered, I now know, but this is a second-hand knowledge from my own research, by the IBA, in particular John Thompson, saying that they were thinking about independent commercial radio, independent national radio. And that clearly upset a number of people in the industry. There was also a concern at the level of costs which, so far as the industry perceived it, regulation was imposing. Some of that was rental, for the use of the transmitters. The radio industry didn't, and still doesn't, pay for the use of the electromagnetic spectrum. I'm not sure that is sustainable even in the medium term now. This is a public resource. If you're using it for commercial private profit and decreasingly for public service, it's very hard to argue that you shouldn't be paying something into the exchequer for it. That, after all, is the basis on which the national commercial stations operate. And I'm not sure that the local stations, especially as they cease effectively to become local and become brands, can really get away without paying.
Your new radio station, Heart, is coming.
Nevertheless, they were concerned in the mid-80s at the level of rentals. They were concerned at the standards required of their studios by the IBA's technical requirements, and they were absolutely right in that. This was a complete nonsense. They were concerned at the costs required of them to pay for the shared news service, Independent Radio News, which I think probably was not justified, although if you were to look carefully, you might well find, I don't know this as a fact, but I suspect that there was a deal of cross-subsidy going on between IRN and LBC, when LBC was still not a healthy operation. And they were concerned at the level of copyright charges. And the copyright issue, which in a sense really should sit separate from all of this, coloured it all, because these were huge sums of money being paid out under an agreement worked out by John Thompson back in 1971/2, for which the industry blamed the regulator. And I think those factors came together. It was decided to convene this conference in the Sheraton Hotel near to Heathrow Airport. I actually think it was 84. So the industry came together. It was the chairman and the managing directors who met. And it gained more momentum than I think many of the people there expected. Certainly Jimmy Gordon has said to me subsequently that he had never expected it to go where it did go. He had to leave early, I think, to go to his daughter's wedding. I think that's the story. And was somewhat taken aback when he found out what the stations had in the end decided to do. And they had effectively decided to call out the IBA. And the IBA, I think, was taken pretty much by surprise. I don't think it had realised how distant it had become from the stations. I think it was anyway itself coming towards the end of its natural life. It was, after all, only to last another 6 years. There was quite a lot of accident in all of this. But that accident happened in the background of a more general mood, a dialectic, if you like, which was going to take it there one way or the other. But the stations and the IBA, I think they shadow boxed for a few years. And the IBA made some emollient statements, and the companies got a little more uncertain about what they were going to do. And then Thames Television made, and ITV broadcast, and the IBA approved Death on the Rock, the programme exposing the SAS killing of three unarmed IRA men and women in Gibraltar, albeit unarmed but planning to explode a bomb in the centre of the city there.
Good evening. The killing by the SAS of three IRA terrorists in Gibraltar has provoked intense debate, not only in Britain, but throughout the world, and especially in the Republic of Ireland and the United States.
The world went mad as far as broadcasting regulation was concerned. This is in the context of the Brighton bombing, the fact that there had been an assassination attempt on the Prime Minister, unheard of in modern times and very nearly successful. The Thatcher government, and particularly Thatcher herself, could not believe that the IBA would allow the broadcast of something so manifestly unpatriotic. Geoffrey Howe and George Thompson, who George Thompson was by this time chairman of the IBA, Geoffrey Howe was foreign secretary, they were political chums. They met, they talked. It was assumed by Geoffrey Howe that George Thompson would do the decent thing and stop the programme being broadcast. George Thompson, to his eternal credit, refused. David Glenn Cross, to his eternal credit, managed the whole process with great dignity and integrity. But the programme was broadcast. And from that moment on, independent broadcasting was dead in the water. Because the Thatcher government, and as far as one can tell, Thatcher herself, was determined that this should not be allowed to go on. That led to the ending of the system of ITV franchises, where the new licences were awarded to the highest bidder. It signalled the end of the public service commitment for ILR. It effectively signalled the end of independent radio and the start of commercial radio. And the whole world was different. And so in a sense, the regulation might have evolved. I think it probably would have evolved. It didn't get the chance. It was effectively overthrown. Was that a bad thing? That was how things were going in the late 80s, early 90s, and that is how it went. Could more of the things that I valued in the old independent system have continued into the new commercial system? I think they could have done. I think the IBA had sort of given up on protecting the public service elements and the localness of the stations when they need not have done so. It took huge efforts by people like Paul Brown and David Vick to get the IBA to do anything once it became clear to them that their world was ending. And it was only Paul and David's work which led to the incremental stations. Without that, the IBA would have done nothing for ages. And I think there was an institutional failure of nerve.
102.2 Jazz FM, the jazz station, with Chris Phillips and Jez Nelson playing you some bad tunes.
The system had expanded to the point where most localities were served by a local station. The question then arose whether there could be more than one local station in any locality. And this was obviously very contentious in a commercial sense for the operators. It was a challenge also for the pre-existing regulatory scheme act, which envisaged one contractor, one franchisee, serving a particular area. And the IBA radio division argued, in the end successfully, that there should be effectively experimental stations put into existing areas to see whether or not it would work to have more than one station in the area. They were known as incremental. And in a sense, that opened up a way for commercial radio to move forward once its regulatory structure changed. That was, I suppose, partly the intention, but it was also a wish to develop further what had been a successful system but could not logically develop much further because most of the areas were served. I was looking around for a job because I did think it was time I went and got a job. I'd actually been at a meeting with George Thompson and John Whitney at the IBA. We were asking for things on behalf of our little company. We were told no. And I came out with my wonderful chairman, Jock Colville, and we stood on the pavement outside Brompton Road, and he said, "You all right?" And I said, no, I'm not all right. I don't think we're being dealt with properly. And I stomped off.
When the day is dawning, Radio 210.
From that weekend in the Sunday Times, whose appointment section by this stage I was looking at, there was an advertisement from the John Lewis Partnership, which effectively said John Lewis would like to talk to successful managers from disciplines other than retailing. John Lewis in those days, recognising how introverted an organisation it was, used from time to time to bring in just people who were different. And I thought, right, and I wrote. By the time they came back to me, I'd calmed down, really. And they said, come and talk. Andy, my wife, said, well, come on. You know, if you've written to them, they've invited you, the least you can do is go and talk to them. So I went to talk to them. And in the end, after spending a day at Peter Jones, seeing how shops were run and meeting the chairman and all sorts of people, the director of personnel invited me in and said, we'd like to invite you to come and join us as, well, it was known as a senior learner, a sort of mid-career trainee, which I did. I spent 6 weeks practicing shopkeeping. I was in the gift department at Peter Jones, to the amusement of some of my friends who walked in to buy things at the time. I then learned about the back office functions, accounts and ledgers and all the rest of it. I then spent 3 months as a section manager in linens at Peter Jones. I then went off to be the home decorating department manager of Helis in Reading, on the grounds, I think, that home decorating was such a small department I couldn't do too much damage to it in a short period. Then came back to be a merchandise manager, so effectively a floor manager at Peter Jones, and then went to John Lewis Bristol as its general manager, so the assumption was that I was probably going to cut the mustard. I was general manager at Bristol for a year, and then got the classic letter from Peter Lewis, then the chairman of the Berkshire, along the lines of, we think you should move to Southampton. So I came down to Southampton. I ran Tyrrell and Green, the department store here, for about 9 years. I mean, it was completely different from running a radio station, but actually it was quite similar to running a radio station. It was a local business, very family. I mean, the numbers were huge. You were turning over tens of millions of pounds, 700 staff at one point. So this is a big business, but actually it's like running a radio station. And I enjoyed it hugely and expected that I would retire from John Lewis. And then Peter Baldwin left as chief executive of the Radio Authority. And I had a conversation with the headhunter, who said, I think you're exactly what we're looking for. While I was away, of course, as a consequence of the ending of the old regulatory regime, the IBA was, I was going to say, quietly and gently put to death. It wasn't actually. It was strangled in the basement of the Tower of London, I think. And in its place arose three organisations. All the technical side was put across to National Transmitters Limited, NTL, which these days is Arqiva. The television regulation was to be handled by the ITC, the Independent Television Commission.
We're here to ITC, you aren't misled.
And radio regulation, under a rather different regime, was to be run by the Radio Authority. That came into existence effectively at the beginning of 1991. So the world had changed quite a lot in regulatory terms. The regulation had also changed. It was lauded as being light-touch regulation, which in the context of the 1980s it was. Although later on in the context of the 1990s, it wasn't perceived to be. And most of the people who'd been the radio division at the IBA moved across to become the Radio Authority staff, though not all of them. And they were headed up by Peter Baldwin, who had been the director of radio in succession to John Thompson at the IBA. And Peter established the Radio Authority. It was very well set up. It was well regarded. He then, I think, was persuaded to stay on quite a long while after the time that he might have retired, but he was retiring. And suddenly the job that in my heart of hearts I'd always wanted became available. So, as they say, I allowed my name to go forward. Well, when I initially arrived, I knew a lot of the people there. It was difficult in some ways because it was widely assumed, and it would have been a very sensible appointment, that Paul Brown would have taken over from Peter Baldwin as the chief executive of the Radio Authority. And that was hard. It was hard for him, I'm sure. Quite hard for me, because Paul is a friend. So there was a bit of repositioning to do from that point of view. I found an organisation that worked well, but that I thought needed a bit of rigour, not least governance rigour. That was also the view of Peter Gibbings, who was the relatively new chairman of the Radio Authority. He'd succeeded Alan Chalfont, who also had come across from the IBA. And so we were a bit of a new regime. I thought that the Radio Authority was a model, relatively small regulator. It seemed to be close to the industry, arguably at times too close, but certainly not distant. It mostly resisted capture, though it's always a risk for regulatory bodies, especially small ones. It was highly professional. Its paperwork, and that's important to regulators, its paperwork was done to a very high standard. In all my time there, though we experienced several challenges through judicial review, we never lost one. And before my time, the Radio Authority never lost a judicial review, which suggests that the processes were pretty robust. And it was fun, because it was back in radio, which I had missed, of course, while I was being a shopkeeper. It was as rough around the edges as the industry was rough around the edges, and it was cantankerous but actually surprisingly good-humoured, and you could fall out with somebody and then go and have a drink with them with no problem at all. It was a lovely environment to work in. I still feel very privileged to have done it. It's one I've had a number of really tremendous jobs. Running 210 was one of them. Running Tyrrell and Green, the department store, was one of them. And running the Radio Authority was another. I've been very fortunate.
There's a range of
commercial radio services, often called independent radio services, and those are the ones that are not publicly funded. They don't get the licence fee money, and they're not part of the BBC's...
The Radio Authority was at a point with the radio industry that it needed to decide how much change it would permit or enable or encourage, and how much it wanted to resist. Because by this stage, independent radio has firmly become commercial radio. There is a beginning of consolidation of ownership. And one of the main things that I dealt with was the legislation to make that change possible. And as the stations began to come into groups, as the companies became larger, all the challenges of consolidation became very much front of mind. To what extent could commercial activities be shared? What seemed at the time more important, though I suspect it was only equally important, to what extent could programming output be shared? How far would networking be permitted? To what extent would smaller stations be given the opportunity to exist because they came into larger groups? To what extent should the radio authority actually facilitate another tier of radio, which was closer to the model of independent radio, closer to the model of community stations, which the radio authority had set its face against? And that is something which I think I was personally instrumental in changing. And so there were all of the issues of ownership as they affected programme output, and ownership and programme output as they affected localness, and as they affected public service. Remember that the 1990 Broadcasting Act had removed from radio any specific public service obligations. And so it was very much the regulatory regime as derived from the bits of the Act that talked about high quality or authority of news or whatever that retained those elements of public service. And of course, localness. And there were extensive, sometimes quite uncomfortable, arguments between the regulators and the regulated about how much it was reasonable to insist upon in terms of local content and what that local content should comprise, how far it was legitimate for the regulator to insist on the operator maintaining the format in musical terms on which the company had originally been awarded the license. The Radio Authority and me took a reasonably restrictive view on that. The industry, as it became larger, as the units became larger and as it became more self-confident, were increasingly willing to challenge that relatively restricted interpretation. And that then produced a number of set-piece challenges, effectively, which changed the nature of the relationship between the radio stations and the regulator. And that shifted during my time from being one based upon effectively personal relationships and goodwill to one which increasingly became based upon the letter of the regulation or the letter of the law. I regret that. I don't quite know how it could have been avoided. And it certainly led in the end to a number of standoffs between some of the companies and the regulator on a number of issues. That made the latter days at the Radio Authority less fun. Certainly the challenge that was raised to the authority's processes and the awarding of licences, which came up after bouncing around various possible media to be a challenge from BBC Television Newsnight programme to the integrity of the organisation, and an accusation that the Radio Authority had behaved improperly, arguably corruptly, I found personally extremely, extremely wounding, not least as it was utterly without foundation. I mean, completely and totally without foundation. There were things the Radio Authority didn't do right, but the notion that there was any suggestion of impropriety or corruptness was so far from the mark. If anything, a little more flex would have made the Radio Authority a more comfortable organisation to deal with, I suspect. But we did not flex. And I suspect the fact that we did not flex may have had something to do with the sources of the accusations to Newsnight, which subsequently produced the challenge. I found that very painful, and its consequences in terms of what we had to do within the organisation, the investigation which I had to commission, the forensic examination of the Radio Authority, was a really challenging time. I mean, the outcome was, you may say, fine, in that the Radio Authority was exonerated. as indeed it should be. But the magic went out of it a bit from that point onwards. And I think that from my point of view, I never felt as comfortable with the radio industry again. And I think that's probably fairly well known. Because you never knew who had put the BBC up to it. And that was hard. It is so difficult personally to deal with being accused of something which you know you haven't done. Proving a negative is immensely difficult. And these days when I see the various accusations that are made of public figures, which we all in our heart of hearts slightly snigger at, it's a bit of voyeurism. I'm reminded of that time and feel for the people who are going through it, in a sense whether they have or have not done the things they're being accused of. It was tough. I'm proud of the way in which the organisation managed what it needed to manage in the time. I think it behaved almost always with great correctness, with very good intentions. It had a genuine esprit de corps. I didn't create it, but I inherited it, and I hope I encouraged it. I'm very proud of what we managed to do in terms of community radio. Community radio in the 70s and 80s had been the preserve of the awkward left and the rather starch and upright IBA wasn't going to have anything to do with that. And when I got to the Radio Authority, we didn't accept the argument of community radio because we did community radio. That was what radio was all about. And of course, to an extent, it was.
Hello, I'm Dave Cochran. I'll be here every morning, Monday to Friday, for the breakfast show. And it's really great to have you along on Murray Firth Radio. And the message in Barbara Dixon's record really...
What it didn't do was to provide the small, very local, non-commercial, differently motivated radio service, which was beginning to be evident across the Western world. And one of the things I was able to do was to change the mind of the IBA, change the mind of most of my colleagues, not all of them, change the attitude of the community radio lobby, but that stays the community media lobby, to the basis that actually they could work with us, and if they worked with us, we might produce something, which became the Access Radio experiment, which became community radio, which seems to me to be the greatest single thing that came out of the 2003 new communications legislation, which wasn't just institutional. And so I'm very proud of that. And every time a community radio station surfaces, I think, well, it would have happened anyway, but the way it happened has something to do with me. It felt like a really worthwhile organisation. I didn't always get it right. Wasn't quite up necessarily to the mood of the times. Just a little bit more backward-looking than forward-looking. But it could do things. After all, it produced digital radio. Against all of the odds, one of your legacies.
The third age of radio arrived today. That's how the BBC described its launch of a new system known as digital audio broadcasting. DAB will offer listeners high-quality sound, free from interference. But the new radios needed to receive the service cost more than £700 each and won't be in the shops for 2 years.
Digital radio was legislated for by a government. We really saw it as an add-on. We're going to do digital television, we better do digital radio. Nobody really knew how it was going to work. And it was the work, particularly the senior team at the Radio Authority, which gave it this shape and brought it into existence. That was a huge achievement for a small organisation working pretty much on its own. And the Radio Authority could do things like that. And I just think back a little bit and wonder whether if some of the calls had fallen slightly differently within the Radio Authority, if some of the attitudes within the radio industry had been a little more sympathetic, generous, I might say, we might not have ended up with a better position for radio that wasn't the BBC when it went across to Ofcom. I suspect it went across to Ofcom not quite in as good a shape as it might have done because of the tension between the regulator and the regulated. We tried to stop the world turning. You may say that was typical of the Radio Authority, but on occasions we had managed it. We argued, we believed, I still strongly and passionately believe, that regulation should be done as close as possible to the industry which is being regulated. It's known as the subsidiarity principle. But it seems to me to be a thoroughly good principle. I believed that, and I still believe, that regulation appropriate regulation was of benefit to an industry, especially an industry using a public resource like the electromagnetic spectrum, the airwaves. And I feared that, put into a super regulator, that the benefit of regulation would be lost and the disadvantages of lack of regulation would become very apparent. Ofcom was always planned to be modelled on the Financial Services Agency. Now, actually, Ofcom has done jolly well, but the fact that the FSA model was a bad one is painfully apparent to everybody. We argued, but I led this, that radio should be in some way regulated separately, or with a degree of separate regulation. We coined the phrase a Friday afternoon job for saying what would happen to radio if it were lumped into a super regulator. And every politician I spoke to then or subsequently refers back to the phrase Friday afternoon job. Nevertheless, they paid no attention whatever, and radio was given to Ofcom as part of its pattern of regulation, which, given the way in which Ofcom was framed, was inevitable and was the right decision. Whether Ofcom therefore should have been framed that way, I think, is an interesting open question. We won't know yet, but looking back in maybe 10 or 15 years' time to the nature of broadcasting in the UK, we will be able to judge whether this notion of putting broadcasting within a super regulator whose primary task was managing the efficiency of markets was or was not a social benefit. My natural prejudice is that that's the wrong thing to do, because I'm a believer that broadcasting should operate as a public good, both technically and in the everyday sense of the word. But that is not how it is now regulated. I think that means our society is diminished as a result. But I would think that, wouldn't I? For quite a long time, we thought that radio would come into Ofcom later. That is what we were led to believe. It's not what happened. I found it actually surprisingly not difficult. Everybody was very sensible, was very realistic. People were worried, of course, but they relied upon the system to treat them fairly, and I think it did treat them fairly. There were many people, myself included, who were sad, but you can manage sad. It's just one of those things that happens as life changes. I left before, because I was translated to Ofcom a few months before the end of the Radio Authority, so I didn't actually have to participate in the putting your things in black plastic bags. I'd have hated that. I would have found that desperately sad. But, of course, it is nostalgic and it is melancholy, and there were people who'd been there a lot longer than I had, after all. So for them, I'm sure it was deeply sad. On the other hand, there was a sense of things coming to an end, which maybe came about as a result of the imminent legislation. Maybe it was one of the things, if you believe in the dialectic, which caused the legislation to take the form that it did. It was 5 years, 6 years in the end, into the Blair administration. The nation was changing. A lot of old certainties had gone. A lot of the social engineering, which had been very much a pattern of the previous decades, was now being discarded in favour of market liberalism. And if the change is happening all around you, you're not actually that surprised when it happens to you as well. And certainly if you get to 2002, which is when the die was probably cast, well, this was a different Britain from the Britain which had applied before the 97 election.
The Labour Party has been swept to power with the biggest majority it has ever had. The Conservatives have been demolished.
I arrive at Ofcom and I have a self-denying ordinance which says I will not meddle in radio. I am not there to be a sort of carried across director of radio. I'm there, well, why was I there? Partly, I think, to be a bit of ballast. Stephen Carter used to talk about me as being father of the house. I think I preferred the phrase senior professional. But amid all these thrusting, brilliant young policymakers, I suppose I was a silverback. I was a person there to sort of suck the air through my teeth and say, well, not sure we should be doing that. And I took responsibility for the regional and national structure. I took responsibility for industry relations, for political relations, along with Dominic Morris and Matt Peacock and Roger Lowry. And it was a very powerful political lobby We called ourselves the Ziegler Group. It was at the days of West Wing being broadcast on television. We played the fantasy, I suppose, that we were the team in the West Wing. And from that point of view, that was fun. The setting up of the organisation was challenging because it was on this super-regulator model, which was a very difficult one to implement because there were five very different organisations which were being replaced and to a degree merged. And how far it was a replacement and how far it was a merger was challenging. But I therefore stayed away from radio. I now wonder whether I should have stayed away from radio or whether there were things I could have contributed. But it seemed to me to be the proper thing to do. And it probably was. And there were times when my fingers itched to get involved, but it was probably better that I didn't. I said I would do 2 years at Ofcom. In the end, I did three. I was happy to go by the end. It was a very large organisation. I'd become immensely fond of small organisations. And I was at the age where I could still contemplate doing other things. So I retired. We took a gap year, because we hadn't had a gap year when we were kids, because such things were not done or affordable. We went off travelling the world, which was interesting. The world was out there, and it was rather different. And then I came back and took on a range of public roles. But in addition, I found I was encouraged to do what I had always really wanted to do on retirement, which was to write the institutional history of independent media. And I settled down to do that, and the book came out in 2010. And it really opened up a new avenue for me. I suddenly found that I hugely enjoyed academic research. I enjoyed the writing. I would never have been good enough to be an academic, but in my later years I could be a dilettante academic. I therefore moved at the invitation of Bournemouth to take on PhD research. Spent 3.5 years researching a PhD into classical music on UK radio, which brought together both of the things that I'm most passionate about. Managed to complete the PhD, and I'm now turning that into a book. And one of the things I'm very pleased to be able to do, both in the thesis and in the book, is to explain all the classical music that was produced by independent and then commercial radio, against the supposed orthodoxy that it was only the highbrow people in the BBC who ever did anything like this. And so I continue to pursue the themes which I've always pursued, which is that there are worthwhile things to be done if you are ambitious and a little bit directive of how media can serve everybody. I still believe that. I am saddened when I see that view being very much a minority view at the moment. But I know that the wheel turns. I know there are cycles in public, social, political, cultural life, and I assume that it will return. But it will return in a different form. I think my main hope is that the work I've done and am able to publish will show what worked and what didn't work about the old regimes. So as and when we come as a society to want a new regime, whatever that will look like, I've no idea, there will be some evidence of what to do and indeed what not to do.